This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up, from bird nests to beaver dams, we'll find out how a new nature series has unearthed the fascinating world of animal architecture. But first, every year, a tiny shorebird called the red knot flies thousands of miles from the southernmost tip of South America to the Arctic and back. Along the way, it feasts on horseshoe crab eggs, which provide fat and fuel for the long journey ahead. But declining horseshoe crab populations mean the food for the red knot has become increasingly scarce, leaving many without the energy they need to reach their Arctic destination. Today, the story of a tiny bird and an ancient crab. We'll talk to the author of a new book which examines the relationship between these two amazing creatures and some of the threats they face in the wild. Have you spotted red knots or horseshoe crabs along the Connecticut shoreline? Join us at 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. You can comment on our website, WNPR.org, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. We'll also be talking with someone from a project in Connecticut that is looking to preserve horseshoe crabs. But first, I want to welcome in Deborah Kramer, who's the author of The Narrow Edge, A Tiny Bird, An Ancient Crab, and An Epic Journey. Deborah Kramer, welcome to Where We Live. Thanks for joining us. Hi, Deborah. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, hi. It's John in Hartford. Very good to speak with you. And thanks for joining us. Let's start first with the story of the red knot, because we're going to be getting to horseshoe crabs in just a little bit. Tell us, what is a red knot?
It's a tiny shorebird, a sandpiper, weighs no more than a coffee cup, and makes this amazing long-distance journey from the tip of Tierra del Fuego all the way to the Arctic Circle and back again every year.
Why does it make this journey?
That's one of the mysteries of shorebird migration. Many scientists believe that it makes this long journey because by going to the opposite ends of the Earth, there are fewer predators there, and so it actually has a better chance of surviving, even though the trip is really grueling and the distances are long. But it stops all along the way, along the edge of both South America and the United States, and so we can see it on its way up and on its way back.
And we'll be talking about some of that journey as it takes it close to places near us, of course, also the Delaware, Chesapeake Bay region. But maybe we can talk a little bit more about why this bird has fascinated people for such a long time. Obviously, this migratory journey is a fascinating thing in and of itself. But what else is it about the red knot that has birders and ornithologists so interested?
Well, I actually would characterize it perhaps this way. There were two ornithologists from South Carolina who, in the first half of the 20th century, wrote this about the red knot. They said that, to them, this bird connotes an untrammeled wildness and freedom that is equaled by few and surpassed by none. And I think that is one of the big things that attracts people to this bird, just the fact that it can fly so far.
Of course, you've also described the red knot as the first bird proposed for inclusion on the endangered species list, whose troubles are primarily a result of climate change. We're going to be going through some of the issues and the problems that this bird faces, including the declining populations of horseshoe crabs. Maybe you can talk about that a bit. We with any endangered species, Deborah, worry about the very thin line that many animal species live on, that if anything about our climate, our environment, an ecosystem changes even a tiny bit, it can really threaten a species. So talk, perhaps, if you would, about the range of problems that a bird like the red knot faces, whether man-made challenges, challenges coming from a changing climate, or just changes that are happening over the years because of the way ecosystems are changing.
Well, the red knot faces a host of challenges because it has so many homes along its entire migration path. And I like to think of it as a ladder going from Tierra del Fuego up to the Arctic. And it's important that most of the rungs, or all of the rungs on that ladder, be whole. And if a few of them are broken, then the entire journey gets jeopardized. The birds live at the edge of the sea, so they need to have things to eat at the edge of the sea. And their food resources are, we don't have a very strong idea of which places produce the best food and why that happens. But you asked me to talk about some of the threats. One of the threats, in addition to the horseshoe crab threat that will be coming down the road, is that as the ocean gets more acidic, the tiny clams and mussels that the birds eat in some of their homes will become smaller and fewer. That's one issue. Another issue, that the edge of the sea is always changing. The tide and the sea levels have risen and fallen over the course of many years, but more recently, because the shore is a lot more congested and there's a lot more development on the shore, it's harder for the beaches to migrate back and forth. So the birds are losing beach front where they can feed and salt marsh where they can roost.
We're talking with Deborah Kramer, whose book is The Narrow Edge, A Tiny Bird, An Ancient Crab, and An Epic Journey, talking about the journey of the amazing red knot, a bird that flies from the tip of South America all the way to the Arctic in its migratory path and relies on food along the way, some of that food, much of that food, coming from horseshoe crab eggs, a population that we'll be talking a little bit more about in a moment. But I think one thing to note is, as you talk about declining size of clams and mussels that the bird might prey on along the way, it becomes increasingly important to get these horseshoe crab eggs as food. So tell us why the horseshoe crab egg is such a good source of food for this tiny, tiny little bird.
Horseshoe crab eggs are really small. They're pin-sized eggs, and yet they have an astonishing amount of energy in those eggs. And when the eggs are concentrated on the shore, and there's lots of them, the birds can snap them up one or two every second. And with all this energy that gets converted into fat, they can double their weight and then fly the next and last leg of this journey, which is about 2,000, 2,500 miles north of Delaware Bay or north of South Carolina, where this also happens, nonstop to the Arctic, with enough fat left over so that if the spring is delayed and there's a lot of snow and there isn't food to eat right away, they can still survive until the spring comes. And they can lay their eggs. So the horseshoe crab eggs are a critical source of food. And when the birds have a choice between eating the tiny clams, whose shells aren't really very digestible, or eating the horseshoe crab eggs, they will choose the horseshoe crab eggs, which is why it's so important for us to protect our horseshoe crabs.
One of many reasons, of course. And so it's essentially, it's a stop along the way. It's like taking a rest stop on a very, very long road trip, and this is where you're going to fuel up for the next leg of your journey. These horseshoe crab eggs are full of fat, and they're full of energy, and so they help the birds along. How many of these eggs do they have to eat in order to make their journey?
Well, a horseshoe crab lays about 80,000 eggs in a season, and one red knot needs about 400,000 of them to make it up to the Arctic. 40,000 red knots, I think, need about 16 billion eggs. And I guess I'd like to say it's not just the red knot, even though that is the primary focus of this book, that's eating those horseshoe crab eggs. A lot of other shorebirds that you can see along the Connecticut coast, ruddy turnstone, semi-palmated sandpipers, sanderling, willet, all of those shorebirds are also eating horseshoe crab eggs.
And I would assume many listeners might be wondering, well, if horseshoe crab populations are down, might it be all these darn shorebirds eating all the eggs, or do they not really have an impact?
They really don't have an impact. The horseshoe crabs come in and lay their eggs in the sand, and their eggs are buried in the sand. And pretty much in many places, that's where they are staying right now because there aren't a lot of horseshoe crabs. But if you go to a place like Delaware Bay, which now is the greatest concentration of horseshoe crabs in the world, when the crabs come up on the shore, and this is a spectacular thing to look at in the middle of the night. You go out at midnight when the tide is really high. in the spring and the moon is full and you look in either direction, all you can see are thousands of horseshoe crabs. When they come in, they sometimes crawl over each other and unearth some of the eggs that others have laid. In addition, if it gets windy and the waves are rough, the waves can dislodge the eggs. The birds, to answer your question directly, are eating the eggs that have been washed up to the surface and are rolling down the side of the beach. So those eggs would be dying anyway. Birds have nothing to do with the decline in horseshoe crabs.
As we talk with Deborah Kramer about her book, The Narrow Edge, A Tiny Bird, An Ancient Crab, and An Epic Journey, if you have thoughts about migratory shorebirds, if you've seen red knots along the shoreline, give us a call at 860-275-7266. Also, if you've spotted horseshoe crabs on the beaches that you frequent. So, okay, a tiny bird, we've described it, Deborah. Now the ancient crab. For people who don't know the full story of the horseshoe crab, it is a remarkable one. It's this evolutionary wonder. How ancient is this crab?
Well, I'm really hesitant to give you a fixed date because since I've been writing about this, the crab has just gotten older and older and older. When I wrote my first book, scientists were saying that the horseshoe crab was 350 million years old. By the time I got to my second book, an artist in Manitoba had been looking for a piece of flat rock to paint on, and he found the rock in a pine forest, and there was a fossil in the rock. He showed it to some scientists who came back to the area, and they found a horseshoe crab fossil there, and then another one further east on Hudson Bay that was 450 million years old. And I was about to write that one up, and the scientist said to me, you know, it would be unfair of me to take credit for this. I think an even older one is on its way. And so I called that scientist. His name is Peter Van Roy, and when he was a graduate student, he was doing his thesis out in the mountains of Morocco, which used to lie on the bottom of the sea, and a fossil dealer showed him a fossil of a horseshoe crab. It took 2 years before the dealer trusted Peter enough to take him to the site, and there he found horseshoe crabs that were 475 million years old. So I guess I would just say that right now it's 475 million years old. And if you want to put that in a context that is a little easier for us to understand, if you condense the history of the Earth into a year, the horseshoe crabs evolved in spring, possibly around now. The first bird arrived in the fall, and we showed up a few minutes before midnight.
So let's just put it this way. It's a very, very old crab. How has it managed to stay the same over all these many, many, clearly untold millennia as so much about the world around it has changed?
You know, Don, I can't really answer that question. I just don't know. It's a really resilient animal. It has survived 5 mass extinctions, including one where 97% of all the marine life disappeared. All I can say is it's really resilient. One piece of it is that when it comes in contact with certain kinds of bacteria that release toxins, which are quite deleterious to humans, it has an uncanny ability to, its blood clots around the toxin, seals it off, and the animal is unharmed.
When we come back from our break, we're going to hear from a horseshoe crab expert who'll tell us a little bit more about why humans crave the blood of horseshoe crabs, how that and also the overfishing of crabs has helped lead to the decline, how this is tied to the decline of the red knot and other bird species. The book is The Narrow Edge, A Tiny Bird, An Ancient Crab, and An Epic Journey. The author is Deborah Kramer. She joins us here as we explore animals today on A Friday Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking with Deborah Kramer. She's the author of a book called The Narrow Edge, A Tiny Bird, An Ancient Crab, and An Epic Journey. The epic journey is made by the redknot, a tiny shorebird that flies all the way from the tip of South America to the Arctic, and it feeds along the way on horseshoe crab eggs. But over the years, the numbers of horseshoe crabs have declined, and so have the numbers of birds. Their numbers have dropped by some 70%. Losing more birds could lead to extinction. And Deborah describes the redknot as the first bird proposed for inclusion on the endangered species list, whose troubles are primarily a result of climate change. We're going to bring into the conversation Jennifer Matei, who's professor of biology at Sacred Heart University, founder and co-director of Project Limulus, a study examining the ecology of Long Island Sound horseshoe crab population. Jennifer, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, maybe you can first describe something Deborah and I were talking about just before our break. What is it about the blood of horseshoe crabs that humans can use in medicine?
Well, there's a special component of the blood that's used to detect bacterial or bacterial toxins in our vaccines. So if you've had, let's say, a flu shot or just your childhood regular vaccines, the reason that we know that they're pure and you won't get sick from receiving the vaccine is that they're tested with the horseshoe crab blood product, and it's the best test. It's very sensitive, and it keeps our vaccines clean.
How many horseshoe crabs are needed to harvest to make sure that we have enough supply of the blood to keep our vaccine supplies clean?
They try to harvest them, but when they take the blood, they put them back in the ocean. So there's about a 30% loss of mortality from that activity, but they try not to kill them outright. So they need thousands, actually, every year they take to bleed. So it takes quite a few individuals to get the amount that we need to test all the vaccines we use.
Of course, that's not the only threat to the horseshoe crab. There's all of the things that go along with global warming. And then there's, of course, what humans do as well. Jennifer, do you have a maybe give us a sense of just how much we and our fishing practices have led to a decline in the horseshoe crab populations of the East Coast?
Right. And in Connecticut and New York, we still harvest them for bait. And that is taking its toll as well. New York and Connecticut have different regulations, and so sometimes it can be confusing as to the numbers taken. And so what we're recommending is the states get together and have a unified plan in order to manage the populations better.
So you're saying that the two states have different rules. Which state has the more stringent rules about taking horseshoe crabs as bait?
Actually, Connecticut is more stringent, and New York harvests over 58,000 just in Long Island Sound.
This is one of these instances where maybe states working together to go across state lines, because, frankly, horseshoe crabs probably don't care if you're in New England or in New England waters or New York waters. They are living where they live. So
exactly. It's one population in the Sound, right?
Yeah. Fishermen were killing almost 2 million horseshoe crabs a year by the 1990s to use as bait. They were thought of for a long time as trash fish. Deborah Kramer, talk a bit more about this and how this leads to the decline of the red knot and other shorebirds. This really is a huge problem that it seems like only now people like Jennifer and others are trying to make a dent in.
Well, it is a big problem, and one of the ways that this problem has been manifest is that in order for the red knot to double its weight in Delaware Bay, the concentration of horseshoe crabs on the beach has to be very, very high. And it was when scientists began noticing two things. One, huge tractor-trailer truckloads of horseshoe crabs suddenly appearing on the nights that the crabs were spawning, coupled with the birds not gaining the weight they needed. Before horseshoe crabs were taken as extensively for bait, 90% of them were doubling their weight before they left to the Arctic. Once the crabs started disappearing into the bait industry, the percentage of birds getting the weight they needed dropped to 30%. Regulations have stanched the astonishing decline in horseshoe crabs, but they haven't yet rebuilt the population. So right now, the low number of birds, about half of them are gaining the weight that they need. But we need more crabs so that all of them can gain the weight they need and so that the population can be restored to what it was before. And as you said, in Delaware Bay, it's down 70%.
And Deborah, quickly, how much of this do you think is due to the overfishing problem, and how much of it do you think is due to the increasing usage of horseshoe crabs in the medical field?
The numbers, as Jennifer pointed out, and you pointed out, every crab that's taken for bait is killed. That's about 600,000 or so horseshoe crabs a year. The biomedical industry is also taking about 600,000 a year, but not as many of them are dying. However, the number that are dying is beginning to equal the bait take in certain states. So we have two jobs, I think, before us, one of which is to continue to regulate the bait industry. Now, in South Carolina, the bait industry for horseshoe crabs has been outlawed. There has been no bait industry there since about, I think it's 1992. And there, the horseshoe crab population seems to be stable. There's no reason to be using horseshoe crabs as bait. There is an alternative bait that is available now that uses either 1/12 or 1/24 of a horseshoe crab, and that bait is being tested now. There's no reason why we can't start using a lot of that.
Could you just explain what you mean, 1/12 or 1/24 of a horseshoe crab? Do you take a little piece off of it? What happens?
I haven't talked to the scientist who developed this bait. It's a sort of seaweed gel, and it has little bits of horseshoe crab in it. So I assume that since the recipe is for using this in a blender, that she cuts it up. Now, it sounds pretty gross, but
it does.
But when you're using an entire crab, to be able to go to 1/12 or 1/24 is a pretty substantial change. The other thing that we're not really talking about here is that the bait is used to catch eels, which many people feel also belong on the endangered species list, and whelk, which is a boom and bust fishery. Numbers are also declining, so we might want to ask why we're taking one diminished species in order to catch other species whose numbers are also declining. The second piece of this, though, is that we really need these horseshoe crabs because they safeguard our health. The international demand for this test, for vaccines, as Jennifer said, but also for implanted medical devices, for IV antibiotics, for so many of our drugs, the demand for this is skyrocketing as the populations of Asian horseshoe crabs are declining. So the biggest concentration is now in the United States of horseshoe crabs. There is a threshold that the regulators set for how many horseshoe crabs can be killed in the biomedical industry every year. That threshold has been exceeded every year since 2007. The estimate for that number may be low. Jennifer said that she thought maybe 30% of the horseshoe crabs were dying. The ASMFC, the regulators, are only assuming 15%, so the number may actually be much higher. So we have to start spending a little more time trying to figure out how, once these crabs are bled, they can be returned to the sea, not only without dying, but with enough blood so that they can continue to spawn.
I'm wondering, Jennifer, could you pick up on that a little bit?
Yeah, the current research is that it actually can impact the horseshoe crab health. They may not die outright from it, but it also may delay their spawning, for a year or so. So the research is still being done on that. But it has effects and impacts, as you could imagine, beyond just the mortality rate.
Jennifer, you know, Deborah was talking about something very important about this. I mean, her book is about these two interdependent species, but they're just a snapshot of all the other interdependencies. As you look in your work to protect the horseshoe crab, can you talk about this interrelation between the crab as bait and the other species that are fished that may indeed also be overfished and on the brink of extinction, the shorebirds that feed on the eggs? It seems as though the case that you're making for the horseshoe crab is one that ties together so much of the shoreline that we experience and that we live on.
Exactly. The population on the Connecticut shoreline and along Long Island is so low that the eggs are not exposed and the birds can't feed on them. So the reason we need so many horseshoe crabs is that as the females come up, they disturb each other's nests and the eggs float on the surface, and that's where the birds are feeding. So it's not good enough to say, oh, I see horseshoe crabs coming up to breed. They bury the eggs and then they're not exposed for other species to consume them. So when they're abundant, there's enough eggs that hatch and survive to grow up, you know, more horseshoe crabs, but there's an excess that's available to all the fish and the birds.
As far as the Long Island Sound population, how much has it changed over the years? Can you give us a sense of what abundant might be versus where we are right now?
In terms of actual numbers, it's very difficult to say, but we've been doing what we call spawning count. So we count the number of pairs of animals that come up on the beach. And, you know, they're in the thousands, but what we've discovered is that females are coming up without mates. And so this has not been seen in Delaware, for example. And so the density is so low that they can't find each other, which is a problem. So the population in Long Island Sound is not reproducing at its maximum rate. And the females are coming up single.
We've also heard of other impacts of climate change, Jennifer, with other species, including, you know, lobster populations in Long Island Sound fleeing for somewhat cooler waters as the temperatures rise here. What are the impacts that you see of the climate change on horseshoe crabs? Are indeed populations moving from one place to another? Are they dying out in certain places because of either warmer waters, different tides, or, as Deborah said before, different acidity of water?
Well, the remarkable ability of horseshoe crabs is that their distribution goes from southern Maine all the way down to, you know, the tip of Florida and into the top of Mexico there. But so they tolerate temperature change. The problem with climate change for horseshoe crabs is the loss of spawning habitat. So as beaches erode, as the waters are raising, they're going higher, they can be losing some of their spawning beaches. So that'll be the problem for horseshoe crabs.
And where might we see horseshoe crabs along the Connecticut shoreline? And what time of year might we best see them, if indeed they are visible to us, Jennifer?
Yeah, they're coming up soon. They'll be up probably toward the end of May. We have a little bit of a late spring in New England right now. And they're on most of the pocket beaches along the coast of Connecticut. I'll be at Milford Point taking groups out to show them. And we have a volunteer network that counts the spawning crabs for us. So anyone's welcome to join us.
And if you see horseshoe crabs at a Connecticut beach, what do you do? Just leave them alone? Don't go anywhere near them?
Yes, if they can, leave them alone. That's great, because most people think that they need to put them back in the water, but actually they're on the beach because they're laying their eggs.
Yeah, they're actually trying to do something there. Just get out of their way, which makes sense. Deborah Kramer, before we let you go, I mean, I want to ask about the red knot. It's a bird that we can see on the Connecticut shoreline here, but it's not as abundant, certainly, as it has been in the past, and it doesn't always make its stops here. Can we see red knots here in our part of the world?
Well, I just looked on the eBird website, which is getting better and better every day as more and more people are submitting their sightings, and you can zero in on a particular area.
And so I typed in red knot and I typed in Connecticut, and I looked at the Connecticut shore, and there have been sightings of red knots all along the Connecticut shore, some in the spring, some in the fall, and a couple in March. And some of them are so late in the fall that you can assume they are juveniles, baby birds that were born in the Arctic. They're coming down without their parents. I have no idea how they do this. I think they have some map that's imprinted in their genes, but they're stopping here en route to making this huge long-distance flight down to Tierra del Fuego. And everything that Jennifer and all of you are doing to make it possible for horseshoe crabs to return to the Connecticut shore is going to make it possible for more and more of these birds to stop there. So, yes, you can see them all along the shore. There were so many sightings, John, that I couldn't even count them all up for you.
Very nice. So there is a chance to see some red knots along the way, along with our other shorebirds, and we wish them all the best of their luck, whether they're traveling north or south on their voyage, and hopefully getting enough to eat along the way. Deborah Kramer's book is The Narrow Edge, A Tiny Bird, An Ancient Crab, and an Epic Journey. It tells us an awful lot about the interdependency of species, and I really appreciate your time, Deborah. Thank you so much.
It was a pleasure to be here.
I also want to thank Jennifer Matei, who's professor of biology at Sacred Heart University, founder and co-director of Project Limulus, a study examining the ecology of Long Island Sound's horseshoe crab population. If people want to find out more about your work, Jennifer, is there any place that they can go in particular?
Yes, our website is projectlimulus.org, and they can find us on the Sacred Heart University website as well.
Thank you very much for sharing the story of the horseshoe crab. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
When we come back, we're going to be talking to a local filmmaker who's telling the stories of the amazing homes that animals build for themselves. You can continue our conversation, as always, online. It's WNPR.org. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on Monday's show, with the pressure to excel weighing heavily on elite students and STEM fields being touted as the sure path to successful futures, what kinds of environments are top colleges providing these days for students? We'll talk with the author of a controversial book called Excellent Sheep, The Miseducation of the American Elite and the Way to a Meaningful Life. That's our conversation coming up on Monday. Hope you can join us. From bird nests to beaver dams, the homes animals build are incredibly complex, designed to protect against the dangers of the wild. A new three-part nature series called Animal Homes investigates just how they create some of these remarkable structures. Anne Prum is a New Haven-based filmmaker and producer for the series. She joins us today from a studio at Yale University in New Haven. Anne, welcome to Where We Live.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell me about this Animal Homes project. How did you get involved in this in the first place?
Well, I am a wildlife film producer, so I'm always looking for interesting and intriguing animal stories to pitch to stations that are going to broadcast them. And in this instance, one of my executive producers at the series Nature approached me and said, you know, there's got to be a great story in the world of animal homes and that draws on some of the parallels in our own lives. In the human lives, animals go through many of the same things we do when they're searching for homes and when raising their young. And why don't you nose around a little bit and see what you can find? So that was sort of the inception of the idea.
And as you started to look at this idea, did that original concept hold up, that indeed animals actually look for homes the same way we do? Or are they doing something fascinatingly different than we did when we decided to, you know, build a home for ourselves?
Well, it's a little bit of both. I mean, you can definitely anthropomorphize with a lot of these animals and sort of the struggles and trials and tribulations that are going on to raise their young and in the dedication that the parents have. But clearly they're different. They don't have a Home Depot. Many of them don't have opposable thumbs. So when they go about building their homes, they have a whole set of challenges that are quite different. But both of those things sort of work in tandem in the series to attract people in, get our viewers in, and then realize that there's something very different going on.
One of the first animals that we're introduced to in the series is an osprey. He's traveled to Connecticut for nesting season, only to find his home has been completely destroyed. Let's listen to a little bit.
An osprey has just arrived home for the nesting season, to a secluded cove on the Connecticut coast. He's flown some 3,000 miles all the way from South America to reclaim a nest he built here 4 years ago. We can only imagine his surprise to find it completely gone. Like many homes along the shores of the Northeast, his nest fell victim to an October superstorm. But he's one tough bird, determined to rebuild.
That's a clip from Animal Homes. It's a new three-part nature series which airs locally here on CPTV. Joining us is Anne Prom, who's a filmmaker and producer for the series. Tell us about these osprey homes, the type that was knocked down in this storm.
Well, yeah, this is a great story. It happened right in our neighborhood in Greenwich, Connecticut, in this beautiful little cove surrounded by these amazing homes. And the bird had built a sizable, like 300-pound structure. These nests are huge, made up of, you know, more than 800 sticks interwoven over a period of weeks. And once they've built it, they can come back to it and use it year after year after year and just add maybe a little bit of, they'll clean out the center of it and add some soft materials. But basically, they don't have to rebuild the structure every year. But 2 years ago, after Superstorm Sandy, that nest was ripped off the pier, just like many of our own homes. So the bird came back, and you could see the surprise on its face when it, you know, sits down on the pylon, and it just has this quizzical look like, I know it was here. Mm-hmm. What happened to it? So the bird does set about building it pretty quickly and gathering sticks. So we were able to capture the build from the very first stick being laid down all the way to nest completion and the raising of young in that family. So that was pretty special.
And what do you know about the products that the bird might choose or the size of the sticks? Are you able to glean something as you watch this long process about how it decides to essentially go to Home Depot to get the materials to build this nest?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, they don't have a blueprint, but they definitely have something in mind. And they're looking. He was looking for things that he could carry in his talons that weren't too heavy, that had enough sort of knobs and little pieces attached to them so that they would catch on other sticks that he was adding. But we also saw that it's imperfect. He would bring sticks that were much too large or, you know, had branches hanging off them, and he'd put them on the pylon and they would just tumble off. And he'd look at them sort of quizzically as they fell, you know, off the pylon, and then go up and get a more simple stick the next time. But, you know, they're limited by what's been broken off the trees. And again, they do this with just their beaks and feet, so they can't break that as we could with our thumbs and our wrists. So he is making a very careful selection of what's at hand in that cove.
When a bird like this, a migratory bird, comes back to a home that isn't there anymore, I assume that there are many thousands of other birds that actually return to a nest that they'd built previously. How do they know where to return to? Is it obvious whose nest is whose, or are there battles over the really good nest in the neighborhood?
Oh, there are definite battles. It's all territorial, and that's why you'll see this time of year the males are back in all of our neighborhoods. All the birds, the cardinals, sparrows, robins are all back and singing their heads off, and they're trying to mark out territories to keep the other males away from the places they think will make great nesting. In terms of the osprey, that male had, once he built his nest, another male came in and tried to knock him off the nest several days in a row to try to claim that nest. So there's a lot of drama around keeping your house intact and holding on to your house.
Tell us about the process of filming, say, a bird or another animal, building a nest from scratch or maintaining a home, because obviously you want to observe the process and get as close as possible, but you don't want to alter the process and make it more difficult or easier for the animal to build. So how do you strike that balance?
We just try to be as non-invasive as possible. You know, you can read from the animal, whether it's a beaver or a sparrow, pretty quickly how much it's going to tolerate. And a lot of times we'll move very small cameras in over a series of days and then monitor them and control them actually from a distance. So the camera's in the nest, but we're not. We also have a beaver lodge in our second show that we were able to get an infrared camera and an infrared light into the lodge. And we tried it on several different beaver lodges, and most of them would just take mud and plop it all over the camera and the lights. They hated it. So we would take it out. But this one family was very accommodating. I don't know why, but their personalities are just different, and they didn't seem to mind it at all. And we have, you know, the whole family with young babies and cousins and mom and dad romping around in front of our cameras.
Hmm. Of course, beavers are one of the animals that people first think of when they think about animals building homes. They're the master builders of the animal world. What new did you learn about beavers that maybe you didn't know going in?
I learned a couple things. Beavers, there were so many more beavers across America, you know, 500 years ago than there are today. And they really were responsible for creating so many of the ecosystems we sort of take for granted, all these fertile valley bottoms. And beavers now, people are starting to realize the importance of beavers on the ecosystem, and especially for holding back water and maintaining watersheds in the mountains. We hear so much about, you know, drought in California, and beavers are what they call ecosystem engineers that can, you know, change the ecosystem, but can also benefit not only the animals that live around that little new patch of lake, but also holding back water for times when it's we're going to have, you know, trouble later on with drought.
One of the big stories, of course, of human building, especially along coastlines, you mentioned Superstorm Sandy earlier. This is an example of what happens when the climate changes and storms intensify and water levels rise. And a big part of human building policy and thought right now is around adaptation. How do we change how we build to deal with the climate that we're dealing with the environment that we're dealing with? How much do you think it's changing for the animal kingdom in terms of adaptation to new ways of dealing with the changes that we're seeing?
Yeah, I think certain animals, just like there are personalities within species, I think that certain species are just much more plastic, are able to adapt and change much more rapidly. I mean, you look at the polar bear that has now changed a lot of its hunting habits, for instance, since the sea ice is breaking up earlier. So I think that there is hope that animals can adapt to the changing climate. Right here in Connecticut, we filmed a sparrow. It's called the seaside sparrow, right in Hammonasset State Park. And it nests in the lowest part of the marsh because that's where it feels most protected. Nobody else is nesting there. But if the high tide comes and a super high tide, all the nests are flooded. And we were able to film the actual babies. When they're about 5 days old, they can actually crawl out of the nest and jump onto the top of the nest for a couple hours until the water recedes. But if they're too young, they don't survive. And I look at an animal like that, and I think, oh, my goodness, in just a couple years, if the sea level rises just another inch, will they have the ability to change and adapt that quickly? Because they're really already on the edge, and they're going to be underwater very quickly.
Of all the stories that you've told and the animals that you've visited, what to you is the most fascinating animal home?
I'm always intrigued. Hummingbirds are my favorite, just because they're so tiny and they're so surprising. And we filmed a hummingbird building its nest from scratch again. It uses spider silk to wrap the whole nest and makes this incredible, artful, soft form that two little tic-tac size eggs go into, and the female is just beautiful, and then she decorates the outside of the nest with lichen and moss, and it was just sort of epitomized function and art all in the same nest. So I thought that was my favorite so far.
You warned earlier about anthropomorphizing. It's something that we've talked about an awful lot, and I wonder how hard it is to keep yourself from doing that, or if you feel that after spending a certain amount of time with these animals, there's actually something to it. There's actually something to the fact that they do have their own little personalities, and maybe that hummingbird is doing this for a decorative touch, not for any other reason.
Yeah, I mean, there may be camouflage. I mean, we can sort of justify it in some way, or maybe it just she thinks it looks good. I think that animals are much more complicated than we give them credit for. You know, I spend a lot of time observing animals, and I think my friends are always really surprised when they hear things like, I never knew that animals did that. And it seems so obvious that they form pair bonds, you know, that the osprey will be together for years and years. So I think that they're much more complicated and more like us. And I think that makes it interesting, you know, more interesting to think about and to study and to show.
We have the final episode coming up on the 22nd. What are we going to learn about in that last episode?
Well, the last episode is all about community. So it's what happens when animals live together and are sometimes forced together because there's no place else to live. So you're going to see some neat birds, of course. The puffins, there's a great puffin scene. And puffins are one of the more adorable birds on the planet, and they have a huge amount of personality. But they have a tough life. They have to nest. They have to fly in and dig a tunnel with their beaks and then raise one chick, and they need to forage very far from shore to bring that chick the food it needs. We also go to Australia. You're going to see some underground skinks that all live together to beat the heat. We have some gopher tortoises that live right here in America, in the southwest pine forests, that create homes for a lot of other animals when they build their tunnels. And, of course, insects are the most social of all the animals. So we have a really cool social spider. I know people don't like spiders that much, but believe me, it's very interesting and very beautiful and cool. And then the leafcutter ants that form huge colonies to gather leaves and then grow fungus on those leaves to eat.
When you say a social spider, you mean more than one spider all together in one place?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
They're about...
So maybe that's the part where I'll get up and go get something from the fridge.
But they're in a very complicated web, so it feels like they're far away from you.
Yeah, okay. So. HD television, I'm not so sure. I have to ask you, where are you headed next? What's the next project you're working on, if you can tell us?
Sure. I made a hummingbird film for PBS Nature about 6 years ago, and it did really well for them. So we're starting out a second one, Hummingbird's Dose, that we're just started on our second shoot. So I'm going to Colombia, to the cloud forest of Colombia.
I have to ask you one last thing. It must be, first of all, amazing to be able to go around the world and visit some of these habitats and meet these amazing creatures. But I think it's so cool that on one hand, you'll go to a rainforest in Colombia, and then maybe the next week you might be just outside your own door in Connecticut on the shoreline exploring something that's frankly just as fascinating. Is that something that maybe we don't give enough credit to, that in our backyard we have really incredible creatures if we just look for it? You know, we don't need a jet on a plane 13 hours away to find them.
Yeah, I think it's true. I think a lot of it is perspective and, you know, just taking the time to look and knowing what to look for. You know, animals are hard to find. So we have to sort of slow down our lives and, you know, maybe take a bird walk with someone who can teach us a little bit about it or go to a natural history center. But, you know, just this weekend when spring came, East Rock Park, just around the corner from where I live, was just loaded with people who were clearly needing to be outside in nature after this incredible winter. And I just hope everybody just grabs hold of the wonder and importance of the natural world.
Anne Prum is a filmmaker. She's producer of Nature's Animal Homes series. She's a resident of New Haven, Connecticut. The three-part series on nature airs on CPTV. The last episode is Wednesday, April 22nd at 8 p.m. All the episodes are available online at pbs.org/nature. Anne, happy travels to go meet some more hummingbirds, and thanks so much for spending some time with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Our program is produced by Lydia Brown, Tucker Ives, Betsy Kaplan, and Kyone Wolf. WNPR's digital editor is Heather Brandon. The executive producer of our show is Katie Talarski, and our intern is Kelsey Bissell. You can continue our conversations on our website, wnpr.org. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Where We Live.